there have always been companies with renowned company cultures and a toxic manager that is the reason people leave that particular team. Elsewhere, everybody's having a great time. The inverse is also true. We just don't talk about it as often. There are relatively stale, boring, or even toxic overall company cultures and great leaders inside that company who manage to create a pocket of excellence and leave you thinking like, I don't understand what everybody's complaining about. I had a great experience at that company. But that's the point, that your experience of working for a company is not actually what it's like to work for that company. It's what it's like to work for the team or teams that you're actually on.
Helping you create loyal customers and loyal employees all through the power of simplicity. This is the Simple Brand Podcast, now heard around the world, including Kericho, Kenya. I'm your host, Matt Lyles, and this week I'm talking with David Berkus. Wait, what? David Berkus is back? Y'all, David Berkus is back. It's his third appearance on the Simple Brand Podcast. Now, David was actually our very first guest on episode 2, talking about how to inspire and align your employees to pick a fight. Then he was back on episode 23, teaching us how to lead from anywhere. This time, he's back to help us learn how to create, lead, and foster the best team ever. And it's all lessons from his latest book of, well, the same name, Best Team Ever: The Surprising Science of High-Performing Teams. Listen, no matter your role, you're most likely doing much of your work within a team. And when you're leading others, you're likely leading a team. So understanding how to have a consistently high-performing team should be one of your top priorities. But why are some teams more motivated, more innovative, more successful than others? Why do some groups of talented people actually fall short when compared against teams of less talented people? It turns out that a lot of it comes down to the habits and the practices that you put in place to bring out the best in your team. Now, David and I discuss how some of the world's most effective teams do this, and we show you how you can do the same with your team. So here it is. Here's my interview with David Berkus. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. You know, Matt, I feel like every time I come back, your hair is slightly longer. And I'm quite impressed at this point at the length you're getting and still keeping it airborne. Well done, sir.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a little higher each time. And I don't know if that's come with age, because apparently once you reach those middle age years, you actually start to shrink a little bit. And so I'm trying to overcompensate and add that height back in through the hair.
Maybe. My barber always says your hair gets weaker over time, right? Which I think is a euphemism for losing it. But yours has clearly not gotten any weaker. So well done there.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to keep doing this as long as I can.
Love it.
Well, congratulations. Congrats on Best Team Ever.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, no, this has been it's been a really fun project. Last time we talked where other people would want to tune in and listen to us talking, we were talking about leading from anywhere and remote work. And one of the things that in working with companies that are hybrid or trying to navigate return to office right now, et cetera, the realization that came from that is just how important the team that you're on is to your overall experience of work, to your kind of employee experience, employment brand, et cetera. And it just felt like, hey, you know what? We need to explore that a bit more. I think in the post-COVID era, even talking about company culture might be bogus, because it's really about the team that you're operating with every single day. The company, you might only actually be at their headquarters once a week or less, right? So yeah. It's been a really fun project bringing this into fruition with kind of that idea. And it's fun that it's finally out there and we can talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, and when you talked about that, the fact that your team culture and your company culture may not be the exact same, like that stood out to me because, I mean, I recall even 20 plus years ago when I had like my first like big corporate career, I went to go work at FedEx, and everyone I talked to when I said I worked there, they'd say, oh, wow, they've got a great culture. But I would say, yeah, that's true. They do. However, it's such a massive company that the same culture really isn't consistent across the company. You've got all these microcultures, and then under that, you've got smaller and smaller cultures.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I feel like what I just said, every single person listening is probably like, well, duh. And that's true, but like we don't talk about it, right? Like there have always been companies with renowned company cultures and a toxic manager that is the reason people leave that particular team. Elsewhere, everybody's having a great time. The inverse is also true. We just don't talk about it as often. There are relatively stale, boring, or even toxic overall company cultures and great leaders inside that company who manage to create a pocket of excellence and leave you thinking like, I don't understand what everybody's complaining about. I had a great experience at that company. But that's the point, that your experience of working for a company is not actually what it's like to work for that company. It's what it's like to work for the team or teams that you're actually on. You know, it was totally true before the pandemic. I just personally didn't have the realization of how deep that went and how much more important that went, because the implications of that are huge. When I talk about high-performing teams and engagement and culture, most of the time, I hear people say, oh, yeah, it's HR's job, right? And of course, no one in HR believes it's their job. They haven't for 20 years because they actually get it. Every leader at every level is chief culture officer of their team, is in charge of the culture of their team and whether or not it becomes a high-performing team. And it's been true forever, but I think it took actually physically separating ourselves from the campus to have this broader discussion about what is culture and why is it more resonant on a smaller team level than an organizational level.
Yeah, it helped. I don't know, like somehow not by design, but I guess by default, placed that magnifying glass on those teams and said, okay, here's what it is. And I was thinking back through my career and thinking of, okay, like, well, what were the teams that I was on that I would consider high performing? And throughout my corporate career, I think there were maybe three different teams. And I had the opportunity to move around a lot and to do a lot of work with a lot of different teams. And there were, I think, three times where in the moment I was able to recognize like, wow, this is a really great team. This is a really high performing team. But I don't think any of those happened by design. I think they just happened organically. So I'm curious, what is it that separates high performing teams from all the others?
I'd be curious. I'm not entirely sure that I would agree that it happened organically, because that's actually quite rare. Like people were asking me during the pandemic, how do you build culture if you're not in person? Like same way you did when you're in person, deliberately and carefully and focusing in on stuff. And when we look at the research, there's a few commonalities and we explore all of these in best term ever. I like to use this totally lame joke just to show off that I was an undergrad English major. But there's a line, the opening line in Leo Tolstoy's famous book, Anna Karenina, opens with all happy families are alike and every unhappy family is unhappy in its own unique way. It's kind of the same with teams. Dysfunctional teams are dysfunctional in all their own unique ways, but happy families, happy teams, high performing teams tend to have three things in common that you can see across the board. And we call those in the book common understanding, psychological safety, and pro-social purpose. Common understanding is kind of the blocking and tackling of a team, right? It's the basics. It's, do you know what's expected of you? Do you trust that other people are going to deliver what's expected of you? Goes a little bit further into the personal elements. Do you actually know your team as people? Those are the things that I think you might be pointing at that are organic. Like we naturally got to know each other, maybe outside of work or in unstructured times, and we clicked interpersonally. And that actually helped us at work on that common understanding piece, right?
Yeah.
But then you have psychological safety, which is how safe people feel to express themselves, to take risks. This isn't like safe spaces and you're never going to hear anything you disagree with. It's actually how the team deals with disagreements and how the team deals with failures in a way that leverages conflict, but doesn't have that drain you and get personal. And then the last thing is that sense of pro-social purpose, which is not just does the team know their work matters. Everybody wants to do work that matters. But specifically, I think people were evolved, designed, et cetera, to view purpose not as why we're doing what we're doing or how our work contributes to the organizational why, but actually who is served by the work they do. There's a not only a performance thing and a motivation thing around pro-social motivation, but even just the way teams bond together better when they know their work is in the service of someone else makes a huge difference. And those second two elements of psychological safety and pro-social purpose, I don't think those happen. They might occasionally happen accidentally, but it takes especially smart leaders to be very deliberate about communication patterns that build psychological safety. And it takes leaders and team members at any level to be bought into the idea that our work matters and here's how we're going to remind ourselves on a regular basis. So You might, yeah, in my opinion, you might get two out of the three accidentally, but I'll give all of your old bosses and team leaders some credit and say that on those teams that were really high performing, I bet you they were doing something deliberate to fill that gap and get at least that last element in a deliberate fashion.
Okay. Yeah. You know what? I can take that. And
you might have even been leading some of those teams. So Matt, let's give you some credit too, right?
Maybe I didn't call it common understanding, pro-social purpose, and psychological safety, but maybe it was the idea and the intent around that.
So that's definitely true. And common understanding and pro-social purpose are terms that I kind of invented. I won't say I invented the concept because the concept exists in the work of a lot of other organizational psychologists,
right,
team coaches, et cetera, who've done the research there. I was just trying to find a catch-all term that combined a lot of different research areas. So this is the fun thing about academics. I'm a recovering academic. We all like to use our own terminology for what are sometimes very similar concepts. So that's not uncommon what you're just describing.
There you go. Well, so to hear you describe those three commonalities that go into high-performing teams, what's interesting is that one of the things that's not mentioned is the talent of the team.
Hmm.
Having a team of really super talented people.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter, or at least it doesn't matter as much as you think it matters. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you offered me a team of people that had these three elements and had talent, or a team of people that had these three elements and did not, I would pick the team of talented people, right? But talent's kind of like gasoline. You still have to run gasoline through an engine in order to get the car to work. You still, like, it's talent is latent performance, just like gasoline or oil is latent energy. There is still a process you have to put that through in order to turn that into performance. And talent is the same way. Just having knowledge, skills, and abilities is great, but that doesn't automatically mean great performance on the outset. There is something that has to go through there. And it turns out for most people, that is the team that you're on, the company you're a part of, the resources you have access to, all of those things affect your ability to turn whatever talent you have into performance. And unfortunately, that's not where a lot of companies think about. We've been fighting this quote unquote war for talent for 30 something years now. And the only people that seem to win are the talent themselves in terms of their paycheck and the compensation consultants that also keep those paychecks going large. But then those people join, and you can point to this in every domain of life. We see it in sports all the time. It's probably the most public place it happens. But we can all think of those examples in work, hiring out that star player, thinking they're going to transform the performance of a team, et cetera. And then it just falls apart. And this has been well documented. Like Boris Groysberg at Harvard Business School has probably 15 years of data now on the idea that buying stars is a flawed strategy for turning around a team or turning around a whole company. And he, you know, his argument is you grow your stars instead, but how do you grow them? Well, you grow the culture that turns talent into performance. You know, I don't want to say talent doesn't matter. Like I said, all things being equal, I would take a team with a great team culture and talented players over one without. But what's that old phrase we always teach kids in high school sports? Like hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. Let's flip that, right? Great cultures beat talent when talent's not in a great culture.
I've seen that too many times where a super talented person comes into a team, but doesn't participate, instill, demonstrate any of those three commonalities that you talked about. And a lot of times, like, that actually takes the performance of the team as a whole even lower.
Yeah. And especially if we look at that middle one, psychological safety, a lot of times talented players and people who have a track record of having been told they're smart, they're brilliant, you had a 1600 on your SAT and you went into this name brand. I call them the one word schools, right? The schools that don't even need university in the name. We all know the school.
Yeah.
And then you went to work for one of the big four consulting firms. And now here you are outside of that and you're in your first kind of corporate gig and everybody's been telling you you're amazing all of the time. And then you get plugged into a team and you don't have the ability to take conflicting ideas non-personally, right? So somebody pushes back on your idea and suddenly you're offended. Suddenly you're like at a loss of what to do. Or you come in and you're so hard driving for your ideas to be the champion, you're degrading the psychological safety that's elsewhere on the team. And that, I mean, that literally, at least in a work context, that's probably half of the time a team falls apart because a talented player joins them. That's what happened, right? That talented player came in and refused to accept that their ideas might be wrong, refused to leverage conflict in a productive way and saw it as an interpersonal battle, and the psych safety of the team just plummeted, and then the performance followed.
Yep, that's it.
The low performance followed, just for those that I need to specify.
Yeah, I've seen it all too common. And then when that happens, there's a lot of turnover in the team too. So then you lose some of the talent, you lose some of the knowledge, and you've got to rebuild. I want to get into the commonalities and go into those a little bit deeper. So when we think of common understanding, how can you build that among your team?
So there's really two elements to think about when we're thinking about common understanding, or maybe the three elements are the three elements of great team culture, and these are sub elements, but that would violate a law of chemistry, right? Because it's been a long time since I took chemistry, but I'm pretty sure elements can't be. So anyway,
I got a D in chemistry.
So. Yeah. I don't remember most of chemistry. Anyway, you like to think of common understanding, in my mind, I think, as two separate spheres. There is clarity of tasks, which is, does everybody know what's expected of them? Is everybody adequately trained on what's expected of them? Are they coordinating well? Do we know who's going to do what and by when? And do we trust that? So this is like basics of project management. You know, this is the charting, the KPIs, the OKRs, stepping the sequential process of tasks, all of that sort of stuff. This is execution. This is, think about a sports team. This is running plays so that everybody knows every playbook. So you could just yell out some seemingly meaningless phrase and everybody knows we're running that specific play. But then you have what we might call, I call it empathy. You might call it clarity of people in addition to clarity of task. And this is, do you know about the people you're working with? Not just their strengths and weaknesses and what tasks they like to do, but do you know about them as people? Do you understand the different contexts that they work in? Especially now in this kind of, everybody's working in this hybrid environment, the context people work better in. Some people do work better in the office and other people work better at home. Then there's work preferences. Communication is a huge one. Everybody's got different preferences of communication, not only what tool they want to use. Some people would prefer to write long, drawn out emails. Other people would prefer to hash it out over a phone call. But even if we're all using the same tool, like a Zoom call, different people have different ideas about how long an appropriate amount of time on Zoom is to talk without inviting anybody else to comment. And so we get these huge overtalkers. So just knowing that, knowing those differences on a team, and maybe even coming up with some norms around the what used to be called soft skills, and then we learned they're actually a lot more important than any of the hard skills. Just knowing that and working that out on a team is huge and affects our ability to execute on that clarity of tasks piece. And so that's why, like I said earlier, I kind of had to invent common understanding. If you want to go nerdy on the psychology research, the first part is called role clarity in most organizational psychology literature. Do people in teams have role clarity? And the second part is usually called shared understanding, meaning, do I understand each other? But they really need to operate together. They're so, in my opinion, they're so intertwined that you couldn't just think of them as two different things. They're fundamentally one thing because they affect our ability to coordinate tasks and work well together.
Wow. So I think about halfway in my career, I was reporting under a new leadership, and this was either before day one or during the first week. She asked me, hey, Matt, here is a form. Can you fill out this form for me? And this basically tells you that this would tell her all about me. So yeah. Part of it was the personality assessments, like what's my Myers-Briggs, what's, you know, all the other assessments. But then it was things like, how do I like to be acknowledged? How do I like to be praised and rewarded? What were my communication preferences? Did I prefer to meet one-on-one weekly or every other week? All these types of questions. And then even stuff around my background and personality, my favorite things, favorite food, all those things. And I just, I love that so much that I started sharing that with other people. And then wherever I went, whoever I reported to, whoever reported me, I would share that with them.
Yeah. And by the way, my apologies, because as you were saying that, I realized you also asked what they are, but also how to build them. Oh. And but it's okay because you stole one of my favorite recommendations, because what you live through,
it's
what's often called a manual of me, or a teammate manual, or a personal user's manual. And you're exactly right. Like the interesting thing to me is a lot of managers who are looking to build this empathy side just assume a personality test will do the work for them. You know, like you said, you put your Myers-Briggs on there. Now, I'm actually not a big fan of most personality tests, Myers-Briggs inclusive. I took it one time. It came back NSFW. And so I've been skeptical of it ever since. Matt's laughing. If you're not, some of you will get that later. I would say Google NSFW, but don't Google it at work. Yeah. Personality tests are great. I mean, people do. There are personality dimensions and we score differently on different personality dimensions. That's a very real thing. The thing is, people don't need to know what your four letters are. They need to know why your emails are so long, right? People don't need to know what your Enneagram number is. They need to know the number of hours in a day you'll be responsive to them and why, right? That's what we actually need to know to coordinate tasks together. So we have to go a little bit further into those kind of work preferences thing, which is what it sounds like that document does, right? So that's a great way. If you think about the second element, empathy, that's actually a great exercise to build on that sense of empathy. That first side, role clarity, my favorite thing to recommend to leaders is to run regular, what I call huddles, what are originally called scrums in the world of agile software development, but I think right. They work so much larger than outside of agile, they need kind of their own term. Plus, scrum is a rugby term, and I have no idea how that game works. I don't understand it at all. I watched Invictus, I still don't get it. But anyway, in a huddle,
you just beat everybody else up.
It seems like what it is, right? You just charge into people until one of you, but there's rules around kicking. I don't know. I'm sure American rules football is really difficult for rugby fans to understand too. They probably feel like we're cheating half the time. Anyway, so in a huddle, for example, this is a regular, maybe it's a weekly rhythm. Maybe it's daily. In Scrum, it's daily, but in outside of most companies, it's probably weekly is a good rhythm. But fundamentally, you're getting the team together and they're not reporting to you as a leader. They're reporting to each other. This is a team-wide conversation.
Right.
The answers to three questions. What did I just complete? What am I focused on next? And what's blocking my progress? What did I just complete? Meaning between the last time we met and now, what critical tasks have I actually checked off? Where am I? Right. So you not only does that give you a status update, it builds trust in me. It builds a sense of reliability that I do the things I say I'm going to do. What am I focused on next? Meaning as we look forward between now and the next time we meet, who's going to do what? Let's make sure no critical tasks are blocked. And then what's blocking my progress is a great question because it's sort of a safe way to ask for help. I'm looking at what I'm going to be doing over the next week or two. And here's where I see potential derailers that I want to bring up to the team ahead of time so that we can put a plan in place to help each other. So what did I just complete? What am I focused on next? What's blocking my progress? Great way to build that clarity side of common understanding. You pair that with something like a manual of me exercise and you can really build a powerful team just through that and through building that common understanding.
And again, like I go back to think of some of the high performing teams that I was a part of and that second piece, what I'm working on right now, we always encouraged each other to share that with the whole team, even if it didn't affect the whole team. Because mm-hmm. somebody might find an opportunity where it could affect them or where they could connect my work to their work and say, oh, wow, I didn't realize that you were doing that. That doesn't really have to affect me, but it can. Let's see if we can work on that.
Yeah. Well, and how many times on a lower performing team, you know, middle of the road or even a drag of a team, have you been in situations where you're sitting there waiting on a deliverable from someone else? And they have no clue you're waiting on it, right? It isn't actually a critical task for them. So they're not focused on it. But here you are going, I can't move forward in my work until I get that piece for them. So having people on a regular basis as a team, not to the leader, but to the whole team say, here's what I'm focused on next. It gives you the chance to step up and go, hey, actually, just a quick thing. I need to get this done by the end of this week. In order to do that, I need this from you. So can we modify your report a bit on what you're going to be focused on so that none of that stuff gets dropped?
Yeah. Here's why I need this in case
right.
you didn't.
Yeah. Right.
And,
right.
And sometimes like, hey, is there anything I can help you with to help you get this done so that I can get it?
Right. And sometimes, I mean, I talk to a lot of leaders who are like right now, you know, are either the whole team or individuals on the team are burned out or what have you. And often it's the highest performers on the team, because if you're not synchronizing up as a team, the reward for doing a great job at work is usually more work. Congratulations. Thanks. You got it done. Could you also do this and what have you? And you end up with certain people on the team that are over capacity. And then other people on the team who maybe don't have that much capacity. And so when you're doing this at a team-wide level, you get a chance to see that and correct it. So like what you said about, can I help you with that? Sometimes it's actually just watching everything and going, you know what? Actually, we need to move this over to Matt because you don't have the ability to get all of this done in a week. And Matt's got some capacity for it.
Yeah. And it's recognizing where that capacity is and sometimes even knowing, oh, who's great at solving this kind of problem. And that's part of that third piece. Here's what challenge I'm facing. And it sounds like that could tie to psychological safety as well, being able to share the things that you're being challenged with.
The reason I love the way that question is phrased, what's blocking my progress, is that it's not where am I failing, but it sort of is. It's not where do I need help, but it sort of is. Help is a four-letter word. I mean, it's literally a four-letter word, but we also treat it like it's a four-letter word. We feel like if we need help, we're failing. Like, and this despite the fact that humans have worked in teams for their entire existence. So the fact that you can't do it alone doesn't mean you need help. It means you're human. But we still have a hard time with that. We feel like it's going to be held against us. We feel like we're going to be seen as a lower performer, what have you. All of our work requires that coordination. But saying, here's where I need help, people are sort of hesitant to do that. So that's why I love that question of what's blocking my progress, because it gets at exactly what we're trying to build in the second element, that sense of psychological safety, which is it's okay to talk about vulnerabilities and failures, and the team is here to support you in that. But if you're hiding it, we can never talk about it. As my friend, the brilliant CEO, Alan Mulally, always says, you can't manage a secret. And when you don't have psychological safety, you've got a lot of people trying to manage secrets, and it's degrading the performance of the team.
So what do you do in that situation where you think you're offering psychological safety to your team, but no one's really bringing anything up?
Yeah. So my question, and I kind of back-ended this from having met and interviewed Alan Mulally a lot of times. My question when I'm working with a lot of leaders is, when was the first question I'll ask them to gauge psychological safety is, when was the last time someone disagreed with you publicly? And that's pretty telling, because if they can't think of one, that's a problem. But even if it's months away, that's a problem. But if they can think of one, oh yeah, we have disagreements all the time, what have you. Then my next question is, when was the last time someone admitted they failed publicly? And then when was it? But also, how did you respond? And what have you. In Alan's case, we unpack this in the book. Alan Mulally was the CEO that turned around Ford Motor Company from about 2006 to 2018. So about 10 to 12 years. I'm blanking on the exact date only because it's a live interview and that happens. And you have those brain moments. And I'm going to build psychological safety by admitting that. Anyway, he inherited a team that did not want to admit failures. Hyper-competitive. Detroit was just toxic in general. All three automakers and everybody. Nobody wants to admit failures because you're going to get stepped over for promotion next time. When he inherited the leadership team, he brought them together and said, we have to figure out why we're losing $17 billion. So we're going to review where we are on all of these metrics. Every week, we're going to talk about what do we just complete? What do we focus on next? What's blocking our progress? And what's really funny is he said, we're going to color code our reports. A green report means everything's great. Yellow means we got some problems. We got a plan to fix them. Red's like, we need help. We're failing, right? And the first time he did it, nothing but green slides, 320 metrics, nothing but green slides. And that went on for 8 weeks, 8 weeks of reports. And every week, and I promise I'm going somewhere with this story. It's not just entertaining, but it's awfully entertaining.
It is.
Every week he would be there trying to get people to go, it's okay. It's okay to talk about it. He started calling yellows and reds gems. Where are the gems? Gems help us unlock value. I'm hunting gems today, but nobody was willing to take that risk. Until week 9, when one executive, Mark Fields, had essentially an undeniable failure. And it wasn't really even his failure. There were production problems at a plant that was building the Ford Edge, getting the Ford Edge ready for launch. And they couldn't solve the production problems, the quality issues fast enough. And they were going to have to delay the launch because the cars weren't ready to go to market. And you get to a point where you can't deny that anymore,
right?
You can't show up on launch day and no one has cars. So you have to admit ahead of time. And so he did. And everybody was silent. Everybody was like, oh, what just happened? Because you didn't do that. You didn't show weakness. If you showed a kink in your armor, someone would stab you. So there's dead silence. And everyone's eyes went to Mark first and looked at Mark for a really long time, but kept looking back at Alan every once in a while going, how is he going to respond? Alan told me he actually thought that people were expecting him to summon two security guards that would like pick him up and just escort Mark out of the office. And that's the end of Mark. But it wasn't. Instead, Alan applauded him, said, he has great visibility. All right, you know, let's cancel the rest of this. What can we do to help Mark's situation? And why I say all of this is that you have to get people to trust you, but really they don't fully trust you and you don't build psychological safety until someone's willing to take a risk. And then that risk is met with respect. It's a cycle, trust, risk, respect. You might build a little bit of small scale trust, but it's only until someone's actually vulnerable, until someone actually admits a failure or speaks up to disagree, which is another form of interpersonal risk-taking. And then people are watching, usually the leader, but are watching the whole team to see how they respond to that vulnerability, to that failure. And if they respond in a way that makes them feel heard, considered, still valued, the idea being that failure is temporary, learning is forever, right? If they're responding in those ways, the cycle continues and people actually trust you more. So in the case of Ford, like they had, no matter what Alan said, nobody was willing to trust it until they watched someone open up their, you know, a kink in their armor and then didn't get stabbed, until they watched someone get vulnerable and Alan responded with respect. Now, if you're thinking, how can I do it faster than waiting 9 weeks? A couple things you could probably do. Number one is go first.
Yep.
Be vulnerable first, right? And you don't have, we're not talking about like deal breaking levels of vulnerability. You don't have to, oh, my parents never loved me and I didn't have a date for junior prom, but little things,
admitting you don't, all that.
Right. But little things like admitting you don't know, admitting you don't have an answer, or showing, you know, hey, the reason I prefer phone calls to long emails is that I'm terrible at grammar. Just those little vulnerabilities make people realize you're taking a risk by telling them. Every time someone has ever told you, gotten vulnerable in front of you, Matt, what did you feel internally? You felt, wow, this person must trust me, yeah. Right? And then naturally, our natural response, and you can see this in the hormone oxytocin, like you can see it in people's bloodstreams and in brain scans and what have you. Our natural response to someone being vulnerable is to go, how can I support them? So sometimes you be vulnerable first and you remind people what it feels like. When you've got a culture like what Ford was when Mullally inherited, or any other sort of toxic team culture, it's because people have actually been trained away from their natural response to see vulnerability as an opportunity. But that's not a natural human thing. And so if you can get vulnerable, and especially if you're in a position of power, you can trigger people feeling trusted. And often they will respond with trustworthy behavior. Now, if you can't get vulnerable enough fast, I actually work with some leaders who sort of stage their own Mark Fields moment. Like there's a trusted person on the team that I can trust to be vulnerable first. And then I, as the leader, am going to demonstrate respectful, hearing them, listening to them, considering them. And that exchange that everyone else is witnessing, people learn from that modeling. So sometimes you can run it that way. It just kind of depends on your situation. But it usually starts not with just saying, hey, trust me. Trust isn't given. Right. Trust isn't earned. Trust is reciprocated. It's that cycle. And you got to do something as a leader to kick that cycle off.
Oh, yeah. Well, in that story, in that example, I think there were two things that really stand out to me. One was that in the moment, it was applauded. It was rewarded. Like the initial response was, okay, thank you. You know, I applaud you for doing that. So you reward the behavior that you want from people. And then two, you talk about modeling the behavior, modeling it for others. If nobody else is doing it, then you be the one to model the behavior and go first.
Exactly. And there's a myriad of different ways you can do it. Like I said, you can go first, et cetera. I'm also thinking in the moment about Gary Ridge, who is the CEO of WD-40 company for a really, really long time. He really, it's just about failures. He really sought to rebrand failures inside of WD-40 as learning moments. And what he wanted was people not to say, I failed, but I had a learning moment. Here's what happened. And the way to do that and build trust is he actually started a contest. He had a monthly biggest learning moment contest, encouraging people to email him in their learning moments. And of course, in the first month, out of a 200 person company, like 4 people sent him an email. But what did he do? Very publicly celebrated that person, sent the whole learning moment out to everyone, wrote a whole commentary on this is what I love about this moment and what have you. And little by little, more people started submitting it to him because they saw that it was getting praised. Now, we're not talking about there are going to be certain people on your team that are consistently incompetent, consistently failures. And yeah, you're going to have to do the hard work of inviting them to try and be successful on a different team, right? But we're not talking about that. Most people are competent enough such that when they fail, it's a temporary thing. It's a one-off. It's an infrequent thing, but it is inevitable that they're going to do it. It's infrequent, but inevitable. And learning in that moment is a choice. And that choice leads to something that is not infrequent, that is forever. That lesson that the team learns is forever.
That's it. All right, let's move on to the next commonality. Pro-social purpose. So I think most leaders understand purpose, but what about pro-social purpose? How do we define that and help?
Yeah, I think most leaders understand that purpose is important and then give lip service to what really moves the needle on people feeling a sense of purpose. And I don't mean to poke any specific people in the eye or anything like that, but maybe it was 15 years ago now. this idea that everybody wants to have a why is really popular. People don't buy what we do, they buy why we do it, et cetera. And that's not wrong in a sense, but it turns out that the way to know you have a good answer is not that you're answering the question why, it's that you're answering the question who. What happened is a lot of people were like, yeah, we need to have a clear why. Let's rewrite our mission statement. And then you get the committee together and they debate the, and you end up with something, blah, 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 shareholder value, blah, 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 community, blah, 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 integrity, innovation, fairness, right? And it moves no one's heart and no one's soul, except maybe the consultant that got paid like 25 grand to run the weekend workshop where we wrote this. Because it turns out most of us evolved to judge our impact on the world based on who we see affected by our work, by our effort, and what have you. We know we're making an impact when we can see who is impacted by our work. And so that's why I add that modifier, that pro-social purpose. And there's a wealth of research here through what's usually in the literature known as pro-social motivation on an individual level in terms of motivation. But there's also some strong research around superordinate goals and other things that people bond together with other teams. They're more likely to commit what are called, again, I'm getting super nerdy here, organizational citizenship behaviors if they are feeling a sense of pro-social motivation. In other words, people are more likely to act like a team. They're more likely to exhibit teamwork behaviors if they know that who as well. And so that's kind of my big message for leaders is that it's not about why. Yes, everybody wants to know why, but the best way to answer why is to answer who and be able to point to when we do a good job, here's who is served by that work, and tell that story often so people have that clear and concise who, and not only let it motivate them, but let them realize that they have no choice but to work together in order to serve that who.
And then if you go back to what we were talking about earlier, where you've got the culture of an individual team versus the culture of the overall company, when you focus that at the team level, then I think it's really important to make sure that you that the team understands who that you serve. Yes, it's the end customer, but our immediate who is this team in this functional area right here.
Exactly. It's often not. We use terms like support role or back office, which are stupid terms to be totally clear, because like they send a message that the people in customer facing roles matter and everybody else doesn't. And that's not really true, because if your job wasn't important, it would have been outsourced in like 1980s, at least by the 1990s for sure. Every recession that we went through proves the fact that we went through it and your job's still there proves that your job is essential. In fact, that book is dedicated to those who do work that matters. And then the next line, which is all of you, right? So, but your who, your team's who may be somebody internal. We could call that an internal customer if you want, or we could just name who they are. That when we do a good job, it empowers this person. And yes, the long-term chain is to go, and in the end, it empowers this customer or this stakeholder or whatever. But you honestly don't need that for a lot of teams. You just need to be able to show how they're making an impact inside the organization to be enough to stimulate that sense of pro-social motivation.
Yeah. And kind of applying that common understanding mindset, that common understanding idea, to be able to pinpoint and see the actual individuals that your work helps to know, here's what they do in their role. Here's their job. Here's the frustrating and challenging things about it. Now, here's what we can do to make their job easier.
Exactly right. And sometimes the best way to do it is not even to say all that in the abstract, but to bring them in. When I have a chance to talk to an organization, like a lot of times we'll do the annual all managers meeting or something like that. One of the number one things I say is, hey, when we get out of here, you need to start sending thank you notes to other managers of other teams. And not just thank you for doing this, but thank you so much for doing this because it helped our team do that. And when you can have that twofold gratitude, those two sentences in a thank you note, not only are you expressing gratitude, and there's once a personal health, mental health reasons to express gratitude on a regular basis, you're giving that other manager a story they can take back and show firsthand. Now it's not them saying our work matters. Now it's you telling a different team, hey, thank you so much. Your work does matter because it helps me. And that's actually the most powerful way to do it, to outsource inspiration to the people who are helped. But you only get that if you get a company full of people that are sending gratitude on a regular basis. Not surprisingly, it is one of the other commonalities you see in all high-performing teams, that there is a regular practice of expressing gratitude and praise, not only inside the team, but elsewhere in the organization.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That that would only make sense to me, that if you're in that and you've got all these other commonalities, that gratitude would be tied in with that too.
Yep. Yep.
All right. One quick last question for you then. What if any of these commonalities or all the commonalities just break down in your team? How can you get them back?
I think usually the easiest one to start with is that sense of common understanding. It's kind of why we put it first in the book. Because okay. If your team's not bonded together, if they don't trust you, if they don't have a sense of psychological safety, like you can talk purpose and a lot of it'll fall on deaf ears. A lot of times people will say, you know, oh, okay, that's just you're paying lip service to the idea, or oh, you don't really mean it, or what have you. And it'd be great. It would be my preference that we build psychological safety first, but it takes time. Trust, like I said, that cycle of trust, risk, and respect. The downside is it's sort of like a flywheel, but not actually like a flywheel. So in a flywheel, every turn it gets easier and easier. And if you're trying to slow it down, it slows down in proportion to how it sped up. That's not how trust works. Trust takes forever to get going. And if something is mistrust, you know, if there's a reason for mistrust, if there's a violation of trust, et cetera, that thing grinds to a halt really fast. So it can take a while to build that sense of psychological safety. So I would say start on that common understanding, start on that empathy piece of getting the team to know each other a bit more. And by the way, every time you have a new person on your team, you have a new team. And so we probably need to start building that again, building that sense of empathy, building that coordination around roles. And as you start to get some success there, you might start to see people feel more bonded to each other. So they're more willing to take a risk. That risk gets met with respectful behavior. And now we're building psychological safety slowly over time. And once we have it at a place where we feel like we can talk about it and people really do believe us, then we can start talking about pro-social purpose.
There you go. And then when you've got that, when it comes to recruiting, my belief is that recruiting is fairly easy because you've now got a destination team.
Yeah, exactly. So you become not to bring it all home. We were insulting talent earlier, but you become that sort of talent magnet team. You have people want to do work on a team where they feel understood and they know that their work matters. Like I could summarize the entire book in the sentence, people want to do work that matters and work for leaders who tell them they matter. And top talent is no different from anyone else. And so you start to become a talent magnet. The other thing that's cool is those talented people, you start to get better performance out of them because they feel safe to take risks. They feel safe to learn from failures. They feel safe to share what they're really thinking instead of a self-censored version of what they're really thinking. And they work harder because they know that their work matters, right? So you get kind of all of it as you build it over time. They interact, they create. A lot of the research for this whole book comes out of a project at Google called Project Aristotle. And the reason it's called Project Aristotle is Aristotle coined that phrase, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And that's really what we're trying to get here. You get a team where the performance you experience is actually greater than the sum or the average of everybody's individual talent. You get something more out of that when you start to build all these elements.
David, I always learn so much from you and the book, but where can we go to learn more from you?
Well, I mean, if you've listened for this long, you're part of a very special club of listeners and watchers called the End of the Podcast Club, the End of the Simple Brand Club. So you probably already know where the show notes are, but you don't know how much Matt wants you to go to those show notes and leave a review while you're there and all that sort of stuff. There'll be links to davidburgess.com in there. You can go there eventually too, but go there second and give a little love to how much work he does in all the show notes. Leave a little review. Tell him how brilliant this episode was or some other episode. I'm really not offended. And iTunes and Spotify don't care either. But check that out in the show notes. And then when you get done with all of that, you can type David Burkus, B-U-R-K-U-S, into just about any search engine and find me anywhere you want, including we reluctantly joined TikTok this year, but you're not going to find any videos of me dancing.
Oh, maybe next year you will.
Maybe. We'll see. I'm not opposed to a collab with Charli D'Amelio, that she just hasn't called yet.
Yeah, just waiting for the call.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much. I'm always happy to see you, always grateful for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my discussion with David Burkus. You can learn more from him at davidburkus.com and by following him on LinkedIn, Instagram, and like he said, now TikTok, where he regularly posts quick, short lessons to help you level up your leadership. And if you want to dive deeper into lessons we discussed today, then go pick up your copy of his book, Best Team Ever. If you're enjoying the Simple Brand Podcast, go ahead and hit the subscribe button, because it's going to make it so much simpler for you to get future episodes like the next one featuring Dave Norton, Huh, that's two Daves back to back. Dave and I discuss his lessons all around your customer's time. More specifically, we talk about how to ensure you're delivering an experience where your customers feel that it's time well spent and not time wasted. So go ahead and subscribe. You'll automatically get Dave's episode as soon as it's live. Until then, keep it simple.